You're listening to the Art Problems Podcast, episode 56. I'm your host, Patty Johnson. This is the podcast where we talk about how to get more shows, grants, and residencies. And on today's podcast, I have the incredible Heather Bondari on the show. Some of you may know her through her exhibitions that she curated at Mixed Greens Gallery in New York when that gallery was in operation, or the professional development guidebook for artists that she wrote with Jonathan Melber, Art/Work, or the update that she wrote on that book with Jonathan Melber, or the conferences that she's run with Dexter Wimberly, dubbed the Art World Conference, or the online financial education program for artists creative study, another project with Wimberly. And that's honestly only half of the work that she's done. And I feel like I've been lucky enough to count Heather amongst my good friends for many years. So Heather, welcome to the show.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Patty.
I wanted to have you on the show because I just think you're one of the most knowledgeable people I know in art. And I also thought it would be fun to kind of just talk about not just what you do now, but how you got to it. Because one of the things that's kind of interesting to me is that in all the time that we have known each other, we haven't done that exact, we haven't had that exact conversation. So Heather, I wondered if we could just begin by having you introduce yourself briefly to the audience, where you live and work, what you do, and what kind of, for lack of a better word, like mission or ethos drives what you do.
Well, thank you for that intro. And it's true, we've been friends for a very long time. And I think you're one of the most knowledgeable people in the art world. So there you go. I live in Brooklyn, New York. But I grew up in Rhode Island. And I started my career here pretty much working in galleries and have sort of floated around doing professional practice things ever since. And what are the ethos? I guess I started with an MFA coming to New York thinking that I was going to be an artist. So I think that has a really big impact on everything that I do because I was really unprepared for what happens when I got here. I don't know why, but I want to share the information that I get so that other people don't feel the feelings that I felt when I got here, I guess. And so, and something that's really sort of obsessed me for at least the last decade, if not more, is just why other people's time is valued so much more than artists' time and the products that artists make, how they are valued in this world. So just like thinking about that a lot and then figuring out what structures exist that make it that way. Like I feel like my whole life is a lot of research and then sharing the research, even though I don't do it in a really academically structured way.
And so if we go back to sort of the start of things, whatever that may be, I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your roots. Like, what was it like in Rhode Island? What was it that made you think, you know what, I need an MFA?
Wasn't the smartest thing. No. So I've only talked about this very rarely, but my grandfather was a sign painter and he was a hobby artist on the side. So he had a studio in his basement and made paintings. They were mainly copies of Winslow Homer's. And then there were some original works that he made, but he was a sign painter and he did neon. So I'm sort of obsessed with neon art recently. And I kind of want to learn how to do it. And I think it's because of his influence, but I watched him. So he was in Rhode Island in the 20s and 30s and used to sneak into classes at RISD. So he would tell me about that. So I think all of that really shapes who I am today. So I grew up thinking like, why didn't he just do that full time? Like, I don't understand. Why was it a hobby in his basement? He should have just done that the whole time. And it looked so obvious to me that that would have been an easy path, but he didn't have a support structure, like an economic support structure. And I feel like I had a really supportive, super supportive family. And he was really supportive. He like gave me his airbrush, things like that, but not a huge economic support going out into the world. So anyway, I think all of those are sort of the underpinnings of my career. And when I went to school, I was studying liberal arts. So I've got come full circle in a way where I teach at Brown now, but I also went to Brown. So when I went there, I was studying liberal arts, but visual arts was my major, that in anthropology. And I never really, I think this is a common experience for a lot of liberal arts students, where you're sort of dividing your time and you have a plan B and you have a plan C and you might even have a plan D. And so I had all those plans. And then I thought, you know, why not? As I was watching friends go to medical school or law school or become consultants and doing all these really defined paths, taking all these really defined paths, I freaked out. And I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So I went and got my MFA because I was like, what if I try to only do this one thing for a couple of years? And it was really informative and really hard and really exciting. And I met amazing people that I'm still friends with to this day. But when I got to New York, all those things that I thought were going to be fixed by an MFA, like I was going to just understand everything and I was going to come and I was just going to be able to do it, they weren't really fixed. And I love Penn State, but you know, they couldn't fix those things for me. They couldn't fix like an economic support structure. They couldn't fix a lot of things. So got to New York and just saw all the other opportunities that I could pursue. And I found like curating and working in galleries to be really creative and really exciting. And I loved working with other artists. So I feel like I totally get why my grandfather had the studio in the basement and just really and left it to be enjoyed, like never sold a thing.
It's so funny that you have that background because my grandfather too did oil painting, and he ran an airline, and then that was like the thing that he did as a hobby. I never really had the question with him though, like, why aren't you doing this full time? Like, he was a terrible painter, to be honest.
That's really funny. I think my grandfather was pretty good. Like, I look back. Yeah. I mean, he did lots of copies, but they were really beautiful copies. I don't know if they're going to fool anyone at Sotheby's, but they were pretty good.
When you got to the city, what year was that?
It was 1999. So that just aged me, Patty. Thanks for doing that.
Now, I mean, I got here in 2001. So we're sort of similar bracket. And when you got here in 1999, did you immediately start working at galleries? And then also, how did you get that work? Because you would have had zero experience to start.
I did. I had zero experience. It's one of those stories that being in the right place at the right time, I think, and just, yeah, being at the right place at the right time. So I showed up and I got a studio in Dumbo and I got a job at Sonnabend Gallery. Oh, first I waitressed though, FYI.
Oh, okay.
That needs to be said because I would not have moved to New York with an internship that only paid me lunch at the time. I got a waitressing job and I worked at Sonnabend and then got a job at Lehman Maupin. But the way I got the job at Sonnabend was because one of my professors at Penn State showed at Sonnabend.
Okay.
And so, yes. So said, why don't you apply for an internship there? And I was like, why not? So it's interesting. And I feel like you would understand this too, like in a deep way too, is that a lot of times we're talking about all these goals for the future and like paths to get there and steps that you can take. But a lot of the things that actually happen in everyone's life and has happened in my life too is kind of by circumstance too. And it's just saying yes to the right things. I feel like the yes, saying yes and no is just so, so, so important. It was sort of circumstance. So I ended up working there and wouldn't say I loved that work. Like intern work is not usually the work that you're was like super excited about. But I
can
learned.
Can you break things. Down this box, please?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I found my living.
Or back then it was like, can you put postage on all these envelopes?
Yeah.
Can you send this fax? Like that was the kind of stuff that, or can you type the label for this slide? Like that's what I was doing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So there was a lot of that, but I learned a lot of the like procedures and paperwork and stuff for the art world. again, not super exciting, but really fundamental to the rest of my life. And then Lehman Maupin learned some of the same stuff. Although in that early time when you arrived, like 2000, 2001, 2002, that's when we wrote emails and we did things that we weren't necessarily doing in 1999. So it changed a lot during the time I was at Lehman Maupin. And then eventually I was at Mixed Greens for a very long time.
So when you went to Lehman Maupin, were you no longer an intern? Were you getting paid?
Yes, I was getting paid. So okay. I did the internship for a summer and waitressed a lot that summer and then started at Lehman Maupin and got to quit the waitressing job, thank God. And then Patty, I worked at Caliente Cab Company. I'm going to call them out on the corner of 7th Avenue and Bleecker. If anyone's driven by there, walked by there or gone there, there's a huge margarita on the roof. It's a special place. I did a lot of fantasizing about just walking out in the middle of a shift, what would happen, the chaos that would ensue. It was very exciting. But anyway, so I was paid at Lehman Maupin. So that was my first paying art world job.
And then after that, you went to Mixed Greens.
Yes.
And so Mixed Greens isn't around anymore, but I wondered if you could tell people why Mixed Greens gallery was a little bit different than some of the other galleries, because it definitely was, I thought.
Thanks for saying that. Yeah, it was started by a woman named Paige West. And the whole idea started in 99. So I arrived not that long after it had begun. The whole idea was to put art online. So I think its beginnings made it extraordinarily different. And there was so much pushback. So before we're talking about maybe challenges in our lives and challenges in careers. I feel like I've done a lot of things that have gotten a lot of pushback. So I've learned to deal with that in different ways. So she had this vision that artwork should be online. And other people were like, that will never happen. There's no way on earth that will happen. That's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. You can't experience art online. And then, of course, and Rhizome existed at that time. So obviously you could experience actually digital art too, but the majority of the art world could not wrap their heads around that. But it evolved in a reverse sort of way. It went from online to then being also in person. And we were doing things that, like, for instance, when we were hired, we were told to be friendly. And then when we hired other people, we told them to be friendly. So we were like, the ethos was being friendly and also being very artist-centered. Like, when I talk about my time at Caliente Cab Company, it was a service position that was clear service, and I did not like it. My job at Mixed Greens was actually clear service also, and I really did like it because I felt like the entire job, and I feel like the whole staff felt like this, that we were in service to the artists and to try to help them realize whatever vision that they had with our limited resources. So
did that feel like significantly different than any of the other galleries you'd worked at or heard of or were familiar with? Like, how exactly was that different?
It did. I think a lot has changed. I think, sometimes when I walk into galleries now, maybe half the time someone says hi.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? I think back then when you walked in, maybe 5% of the time someone said hi. Like, I just feel like there still is, because the art world sort of runs on this idea of exclusivity. It's how the market is sort of built. But I think back then that was really taken on every level. It was like you couldn't even talk to someone behind the desk at the time. So,
and they never looked up and you sort of felt like you shouldn't look up. I worked a desk job at a gallery. Nobody told me not to look up, but I'd been to enough galleries that I kind of knew that I wasn't supposed to. But I sold a lot of work there because I did actually talk to the people that came in.
I mean, back then, not to talk about anyone specifically, but I think in general, people who worked behind the desk in galleries were also told, not to give prices to certain types of people, to give prices to other people, like don't give prices unless an owner was present. Like, so there was a lot of secrecy and a very careful vetting of information. I started in the art world with that, and I was, even though I'm old at the time, I still was like, there's something wrong with this. Like, this doesn't feel good. And I also knew that if I walked into a place like that, well, I knew when I walked in, I was not going to be given prices. Like, I was not going to be looked at. And I'm like a white lady. Like, so I just couldn't, it was really felt wrong. And Paige, who started Mixed Greens, this was interesting. I think one of the reasons why we were all super friendly, we put prices online. I didn't mention that before. How were we different? Super different. We put prices online from the beginning. And now some people have come around to that and they're a different, I just saw an Instagram reel with, what's his name, Patty? Magnus.
Oh, Roush. Isn't that, I'm not sure if that's how you say his last name, but yes.
Yeah. Talking about how if you put prices online, it's, I don't remember the statistics, but it's like 80% more likely that you're going to sell the thing. Like, so for artists, yeah.
That's true. But I mean, this is a little bit of a digression, but I think it really depends on what your purpose is, right? Like if you're an artist, and your goal is to have somebody else sell the work for you, maybe you're communicating something different by putting your prices online.
Yeah, I don't want to simplify that. But at the time, like we were like, well, there are a lot of art. We realized that a lot of people who were buying the work were also artists supporting each other. And it was people who, if you put the price, they were like, oh, this is because we were showing emerging artists. So especially at that time, the prices were like fairly reasonable. And we tried to always, even 16 years later, have prices that were accessible. And we also did payment plans and all kinds of things like that. So we realized that there were a lot of people who normally would have walked into a gallery and assumed, I can't afford anything here. Like, this is absolutely inaccessible. I'll look at it and I'll like it, but there's no way I could ever live with this. And then if you put the prices out, and they were reasonable, they were like, oh my God, people were so surprised by how
interesting
accessible some of the works were. So a lot of our real, really big supporters were other artists, which was interesting in those early days. So yeah, but Paige is a collector who I remember her telling stories about those early days when she would walk into galleries and she owned a lot of work and she would be absolutely dismissed by the people behind the desk. Like, they wouldn't give her a price list. They'd ask her her bio before she was able to get a price list. And she's not the kind of person that's going to say, I like talk herself up to be this really big deal. And so she felt extraordinarily uncomfortable in those situations. And she's like, can't a shy person that doesn't want to talk to me, like, or talk to any of you guys, can't they buy something? Like, let them buy something. Like, let them buy something in their pajamas at home at 10 p.m. So, but it was different. Obviously, this is a very different time, 24 years ago, when a lot of artists did not have their own websites and things like that. So we were offering things by having that website with the prices and all that they didn't have themselves. It was really expensive. Do you remember, Patty, how expensive it was to make a website back then? It's insane.
I mean, I remember I had a blog when I had my blog redesigned. I didn't think it was that expensive. It felt expensive at the time. It was maybe like $4,000 to get it down.
Done. Yeah, I feel like back then, like to get one that was more robust, that actually had e-commerce on it or something, that was like, it was tens of thousands.
I was going to say, I can't imagine how much those kinds of functionalities would cost.
Yeah, I know.
And there's nothing out of the box, right?
Yeah, no, there was nothing. You had to have a coder do all of it. So it was super different. So yeah, so it was exciting to like do something different and new and interesting. And then we turned more and more traditional as the years went on or everyone caught up. Yeah, it was a very, very interesting experience. And I think I did a lot of learning during that time.
And you worked with people that I think you really liked. Wasn't that the case? Like,
love them. Love all of them. And I still like staff and artists both. So we all are still pretty close. Yeah.
And when did Mixed Greens close?
2016.
So 2016, so shy of 10 years ago. So what happened next?
I've done so many things since then that are, they all have a similar thread, but they're very different. So I did work at Smack Melon as director of exhibitions. So I wanted to try some nonprofit work and see what that was like, because I do feel like when you said Mixed Greens was different, there were lots of technical reasons why we were different, including the website and the prices and things, and the ethos. So the ethos was very much nonprofit. I felt like it was a for-profit with a nonprofit heart. Like, that's how I describe it, because it was artist-centered. So I was like, oh, I was working at Mixed Greens, so I think I should probably work at a nonprofit. I would enjoy that. So I did that for a bit, but ended up coming out of the nonprofit world, doing a lot of things on my own, although never on my own. I'm going to be clear about that. Everything that I've done has been with other people. So ran mixed screens with other people, wrote the book with someone. You mentioned Jonathan Melber, wrote the book with Jonathan Melber. Like, I've been working with Dexter Wimberly pretty much ever since, close to when I stopped working at Smack Melon, I believe, where we did art conferences, and we now have a platform called Creative Study. I tend to do things in groups or partnerships.
You know, I wondered if we could dig into that a little bit, just because it's hard for me to imagine doing something totally solo. But I think before we got on, one of the things that I said to you was that I felt like your choices have not always taken like what I would consider to be an easier path, right? Like, maybe this reflects what I don't know about the path of an art advisor or something like that. But, you know, you have enough experience to work in that field and to navigate the sale and show of artist work. And you chose not to do that. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was kind of curious about that decision. And I guess the other thing I wanted to say, though, is that I don't know that anybody truly does anything alone. You know, like, I can't imagine what a solo project really looks like.
I know. I woke up one day, like a couple of years ago, and I was like, wait, all these things, I always need a partner. I feel like I have different personality traits that need to be balanced. I have different skills that need to be balanced. I have different interests that need to be balanced. But I think a lot of these, like taking the, when you said you've taken a harder path, I had a really strong reaction. Because I sometimes think that, and sometimes I don't think that. I'm not sure. Like, the things that I've done in the last few years and starting things like with Dexter and just talking about what we've learned publicly and through other people, like gathering people and having workshops and talking about business and financial health in the arts, it seems like a culmination of a lot of the things that we've learned along the way. But yeah, starting something, as you well know, starting something from scratch is really hard. And being able to blame a system or a structure or a group of bosses is a little easier sometimes, I think, because you're the boss and so you have to blame yourself, and then that gets really tricky. And I know I have a mom who will say things when, like, if I say I can't do something because I have events that weekend or something, she's like, well, tell them that you can't go. Tell them that you're too exhausted. And I'm like, Mom, who's them? Them is me. Them is me. So having to put like boundaries and limits around yourself is really hard when you work for yourself. But I think the work has been super interesting. Like, the art consultant route, I have friends who do it that I think their work is so fascinating. Like, working with collectors to try to get so fascinating to me. But I don't think I could do that, because I think that what I've realized is that that artist-centered ethos, where it's really figuring out the artist's goals and needs and project wants, that's what I'm interested in. I'm not necessarily interested in the person who's collecting the results of that. I think they need to exist. They have to exist, because a lot of what an artist is capable of doing relies on that kind of money being infused into our world. No matter how anti-capitalist I am, I know I need a budget to do things. So I'm much more interested in working with the artist. And I think that you're right. For everyone who works with artists, who's artist-centered, it is a harder path because of maybe what I talked about at the beginning, that value. Like, we're all struggling to try to increase the visibility and the perceived worth of the work that we're all doing.
Do you feel like when you talk to artists, because I mean, you've been doing this your entire life at this point, like, where do you feel the biggest challenges are? I think we've just talked about sort of financial hardship. Is it that, or is it the how it kind of ricochets out? Is there one point that you could identify where you're like, okay, this is the sticking point here?
I mean, I guess because I teach, I feel like the biggest challenge is when you're working with artists or when you are an artist is figuring out what you actually want. I feel like that's really hard. And for students, my goal, and I don't know, you'd have to have my students on to actually see if I achieve this, but my goal is always to show them different possibilities. But really, in the end, it's kind of like what you do, like with your rubrics and things, like have people figure out like what they actually need and what they want and what their definition of success is. Because once you do those things, I'm not saying the financial part just comes, but I feel like figuring out how to achieve those needs, you need to know what you need and want before you can actually get those things. And so figuring out what kind of artist you are, like I worked in galleries for a long time. I'm the first person to tell artists that like gallery, showing in a gallery is only good for a certain percentage of the population. And it's not that big. And because the actual desires of most artists do not revolve around four white walls and a pretty small viewership in the end. And I know, I guess with my students, I've noticed over the past 10 years how a lot of them were very, very interested in showing in galleries in the beginning, when I first started teaching. And now there are a lot, I find myself answering the question, like, what's a gallery good for more often now than
oh,
I ever.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting.
And I feel like that's changed also because of what you said before. Like in the beginning, Mixed Screens had this online presence and all the stuff that artists didn't have. Now the gallery has an online presence, but so does the artist. And a lot of times the artist is better at it than the gallery is because they're able to only attend to their own needs. So it's a really different situation. And I'm very curious to figure out like how all those structures are going to change in the coming years. And I feel like things are changing a lot more.
Okay.
Now,
yeah.
Years ago. But and, I don't know if I answered your question.
I mean, how do you think they are changing? We just talked about there being a questioning of the role of the gallery. Is that the only place that you see a change, or are there more places where that's showing up?
No, I think there's changes in all different aspects. I feel like in grant making, there are so many changes that are taking place now too, where artists are, well, hopefully, at least it seems so from the outside. I have not worked at a grant-making institution yet, but I've talked to a lot of people. I think that artists are being trusted more, or the best practices now is more trust the artist more, simplify the application, like try to don't have as much reporting or no report. Like there are all these rules that are slowly shifting, I think, to be more trusting of an artist knows what they need and giving money without as many strings. I'm also a big fan of guaranteed income. So that's like taking it all the way to an extreme. Of giving artists money just because of who they are, not because of the work that they're making, not because of, you know, a product that they've created or a thing that they've achieved. Just to be a creative person in the world, that needs to be supported because we all benefit from that. I feel like there's a huge movement, and I want to plug Creatives Rebuild New York and their Guaranteed Income Project. And their white papers are going to be coming out like over the course of the next year. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of advocacy needed around that. So I've seen like that is hopefully taking hold. Then I've seen like grant-making institutions kind of changing the way that they're considering applicants and what they're holding them to at the end, and then the galleries. And I just feel like more and more people seem to be collaborating. And again, it might be just from the outside. It appears that way. I'm not sure what's happening on the inside of some of these places, but I find it hopeful.
I like that, especially in an election year. That feels really nice.
Mm-hmm.
So you think that you find it hopeful because you think that there is maybe greater stability for artists or greater maybe flexibility for how they can participate in creative ways within the culture?
I think so. I think there's like, it's opening up. I feel like the artists who could clearly be supported in the past. And again, this might be my myopic like vision, but when I first entered this world, and I was also scared and I didn't know a lot, but I felt like painters and sculptors were the ones that could see a path towards stability and even thriving. And that is still the case in this point in time. I feel like there are still structures in place to really support those people because they're much more easily involved in the market. But I've also seen like so the definitions of what should be supported in the arts by really big institutions that kind of dictate the way we talk about art. It's just, it's growing. I feel like more and more artists are entering that sphere that don't fit those old definitions of what art is. Or they're just, once they get in on the inside, they're really questioning. Like I saw an artist speak the other night and someone asked, you know, why did you write craftsperson and fine art? It was something like artist and craftsperson on your website. What do you think about those two things? And she's like, I don't actually care about the definition between those two things. Don't care. But I know some people do. And I want to give both camps something when they come to my website, because I grew up in this thing where I couldn't make craft. Now I can make craft, but there's still, everyone has a different opinion. So just throw it all in there. I don't care how you define it. I'm letting you access my work. So I feel like they're like, it's just much more, I don't know. It is, I've seen in the last 20 years, like boundaries sort of crumbling between certain things. And I don't feel like it feels fair yet. Like I know you would be the first person too to talk about this. Like it doesn't feel like it's everything's possible and everything's fair and it's all good now. That's not what I'm saying, but I'm saying that I can see a difference, not fast enough. And probably, like, definitely not fast enough. Also, I feel like I am the first person to say, too, like, this art world that we're talking about, Patty, like, that everyone wants to get into, I don't, in the end, who cares? Like, there are so many different artists and creative people that are out there that will never have their names in Art Forum, won't ever show in a gallery in Tribeca, and they're going to be making the most amazing work and actually making a living and doing the thing that they like to do. And, like, let's support those people, too. I think you're a big fan of that as well.
Yeah, I am. I mean, I listen to podcasts and audiobooks during the runs that I do. For the last couple of days, I've been reading, listening to Get the Picture. Have you read that book yet?
No, tell me.
Because it talks a lot about the exclusivity of the art world. Mm-hmm. At least at the beginning, it feels very much like the art world I hate. There's a lot of talk about, you know, what kind of clothing you need to wear and like how many coats of paint you should have on a wall, like stuff that I think, I don't know, just like lends a level of like both superficiality and kind of willful mystery that mm-hmm. I don't think the art world necessarily needs to run off of. But I think like also that book, like I can hear certain chapters and I'm like, oh, that was, the reporting was done in 2019 on this one. Like, and already that feels old.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm not sure maybe where I was going to go with that. I do think that there's something to what you're saying about like an art world that is maybe a little bit more open and that does seem to be changing. I think like last, I don't know, I think maybe it was in October or something. It was like, suddenly I went to the galleries in Chelsea and it was like, they were all sent the same memo where they were supposed to say hi from the front desk. And, you know, I went into Paula Cooper, and for anybody who's been in the art world for a little while, like you will recognize Paula Cooper and the people at Paula Cooper's desk as being like one of the galleries that's just like, they have this stony face, like you don't really get to talk to the receptionist. And it was clear that somebody had been told that they needed to say hello in a friendly voice to every single person that came in. And I went down the street and that was sort of the way it was at every gallery. And I was like, it really feels like somebody just sent a mass email to all the galleries in Chelsea and said, this is what the new rules are going to be. And everybody started following them, which is, I don't know, kind of interesting to me.
I think it's interesting. And like, that's a, I mean, that makes a huge difference, actually. It's like such a little thing, but it's a huge difference. Like actually welcoming people into an art space. So basic. It's so basic, but it definitely was not the way that things were done. And I'm curious, and I think it has a lot to do with just awareness of other people and care. And maybe you were talking about the election year too. I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but things are changing.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if you could talk a little bit we talked a little bit about, you know, the challenges that somebody has, like, and the way that they can get through those challenges, like as a younger artist or even like mid-career, you know, what do I want? How do I get there? I'm also wondering, like, what are some of the things that people, that artists need right now that they maybe don't have?
I think the reason that I like the changes that I'm hearing about in the grant making world is that trust that artists know what they're doing, and that vision is really, their perspective on things is really important, and the things that they make are also really crucial to like the way our democracy works. So I feel like there's that, to recognize that is one thing, but you also have to support it. So I feel like it's hard. I'm not sure if I'm going to answer your question, but I think like early in someone's career, the things that I see is just like time, it's like time management and things like that. I feel like all of those are the big obstacles that I think a lot of younger artists have. It's like, how do I manage my time and still be able to pay my rent? How do I balance my practice with the other many things that I have going on in my life? And some of them might be, you know, revenue generating and some might not. And how do I do that? Like, how do I make an impact on the world and pay my rent? And can it be the same thing? Can I do the same thing to do both those things? Like, just figuring out like where you fit. And then the changes that need to be made is, I feel like there just needs to be more support across the board. I mean, it would be wonderful if it was governmentally supported as well, but more people need to step up to help.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, especially with the time thing. And I'm not even sure that that's something that is so specific to younger artists. I think that the types of time challenges are a little bit different, because when you're younger, you may not necessarily know how to prioritize your time. And so that lack of experience can mean that you spend time on the wrong things. As you get older, you have a better sense of priorities, but you may not necessarily be any better at figuring out like which things you need to prioritize. Because if you don't know where you're going, or like where even necessarily, and I think this is probably more important, like where you're starting from, then you're not going to be able to figure out these basic questions of like, this is what I'm going to do today to move the ball forward on my career. And all of this is tied up with a structural issue of everybody having way more things to do than time to do them in. And I think that's particularly true for people who are creatives, like artists, people like you and me, entrepreneurs. Like, the reason we live the life we do is that we have a lot of ideas for things. And that's very fulfilling. But it does mean that you never have enough time to do all the ideas you have.
Right. I think I love that. You talk a lot about that, about working smarter, not harder, or that you're so busy. So busy doesn't mean you're actually doing what you should be doing. And also the point about knowing where you're at, because I do think a lot of artists and arts workers don't give themselves credit for what they've actually achieved or where they actually are. And once you know like all the tools you actually have and the experiences you have, I think it's easier to take the next step forward on things when you realize where the deficits are, but you can also appreciate how far you've come in certain areas. And even for an emerging artist, like mid-career artist, for sure. But even an emerging artist that thinks like the way that I was when I came, and I'm like, I don't know anything. I know nothing. And I'm like so lost. And if I had done your rubric and figured out exactly what I did know, it might have been helpful to see the positive in some of the struggle. All those things, super important.
For everyone listening here, the rubric that Heather keeps referring to is something that I actually tested first on the Brown class, but it is something for the next cohort of network members, and anybody who is a network member, you're going to experience that rubric. So I think that's We literally just finished everything yesterday. So excited. I don't think I've worked so hard on anything. What have you done recently, or even like in the past? Like, what are the projects you're most proud of? And why?
I guess the couple of projects that I've been working on recently, I mean, in general, I'm very proud of the legacy of Mixed Greens, actually. Yeah. And I think that had a lot to do with everyone who worked there over the years and all the artists. I feel like we ended, like endings are so hard. And so I'm very proud of the way we ended. That's kind of interesting. I've thought a lot about that over the last few years. So there's that. That's a while ago. And more recently, creative study, I'm very proud of. I'm just starting that from scratch. So as a beginning, so the ending of Mixed Greens, the beginning of creative study, which is, again, business and financial health education online, asynchronous. And then recently, I'm really excited and really happy about working with a few people who have been concerned with legacy and archiving. And so I worked with Ruby Lerner last year on her archive. So you can go to rubylerner.com now, and she actually has a website where you can search all her writing. And I feel like she was such a groundbreaking person who actually paved the way for people like you and me to talk about this kind of stuff.
And Ruby Lerner was the founder of Creative Capital, right? An organization that gives artists upwards of $50,000 for what they call groundbreaking work.
A lot of people know her for that and worked there for many years until she retired, although she's never actually retired, but worked there for many years. But before that, she did a lot of speeches and writing about funding cuts for the NEA and was very activist-y in her writing and in her work. And she ran four different organizations over the years. But she had no online presence with any of this stuff that she wrote. And some of the things you find she wrote in the 80s, and it could have, if you don't see the date, you think it was written yesterday.
Really?
And that's been super informative to me to read those things and see the cyclical nature of a lot of these issues. I mean, all kinds of civil rights and stuff she was writing about in the early 80s in reference to arts institutions and how philanthropy needed to change and how we're talking about the exact same things now.
I remember I was on this panel on feminism when I was just starting out. I might have been like 25. And Joan Semmel was on the, she wasn't on the panel, but she was in the audience. I think Mara Riley was on the panel. And a lot of the older feminists in the audience were complaining. You know, they were like, we had these talks in the 60s and 70s. Like, nothing has changed. When are you when are we actually going to start talking about different problems?
Exactly.
And different solutions? Because the ones we have, like, don't seem to have worked. You know, I think that there's something that's like, what you're saying, that like, you can take the lens of this being kind of hopeful.
Like, yes. And I think she taught me, like, after reading all of this, I was like, Ruby, this is so dark. It's so depressing. But then she's so hopeful still. And I was like, wait, yeah. She's so hopeful. And then I just did a project, an archiving project with Lynn Hirschman Leeson, who's a really groundbreaking new media artist who's had a 60-year career. She's 83 right now and amazing. She actually has a show up at Bridget Donahue, which by the time this airs, I don't know if that'll still be up. She is also extremely hopeful, and she sees artists and arts workers as antibodies in the world, like that we're antibodies. And she's made antibodies, so she's very into like bio tech and art. But I love that image of like, where are the antibodies?
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah. And it's so you're working on the artist archives, and you did Ruby Lerner's archive last year.
Yeah.
If people want to find out more about you, what should they do?
What should they do? You can go, I do have a website. It's really lame, but you can go to heatherbendari.com and see a couple things, but and get in contact with me. And you can go check out rubylerner.com or lynnhirschman.com and see those projects as well. I'm around, so just keep an eye out. I show up in very unexpected places.
I do also want to say that this book, the artwork book, I think this is the older version. You have a more updated one, but I actually refer to that book all of the time in the strategy calls that we have, because what that book is just a very practical nuts and bolts guide to like relationships with galleries and pretty much everything you need to know to manage your studio. If you're looking for anything like nuts and bolts like that, it's really great. And it's written like a human wrote it, which I really like.
We did try to write it like humans, so with really plain language, because it does not have to be complicated. A lot of this stuff is not complicated. Doing title, date, medium, not complicated. We don't have to do it that way. I am proud of that book a lot. I totally forgot about it when you just asked that question. So yeah, we redid it. It's yellow now. And then I am working on revisions to it at the moment. So while these big things, big picture things are changing, like slowly but surely, a lot of those nuts and bolts, paperworky things are not changing and have not changed. Although there are words that I need to change in that book that have to do with like printing or DVDs or CD or like anytime we refer to anything like that, I'm getting rid of it. Also, there are things like pronouns and stuff that we're like changing it up. It's more in line with the way people talk today. But in general, a lot of those nuts and bolts are here for at least the moment.
Well, that's fantastic. Heather, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. For everyone here, we'll have all of the links to anything you might want in the show notes. So take a look there, and I will see you all next week. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you, Patty.
Thank you for listening. If you like the show, please leave a review and share it with a friend. It really helps get that valuable information out to more artists just like you. You can find all of the names and the links that we reference in this conversation at workshop.art/podcast.